morning is a good opportunity to circle back, okay? Because we've said up to this point in our time working our way through John's account that one of his primary purposes here is to ask the question, how would you respond to Jesus? How do you respond to Jesus? And this is crucial, right? You might be here this morning and you might be investigating Christianity and you're not sure what you believe, what you think about the Bible's claims, all of this. You need to understand that at the very center of that exploration is Jesus himself. And so, you know, in many ways, this is why John's gospel account is so helpful to hand out to our non-believing friends, to skeptics, to people who are like, I'm not sure about this, and to read through if you're a spiritually seeking person, because it really cuts to the primary issue in Christianity. And it really shows how Christianity is set apart from other world religions in the sense that, you know, if you were to explore or investigate another world religion, at the center of that investigation is often investigating the way, you know, in the sense of like the rules to follow or not to follow, or the way in the sense of the way of life, the way of living as a, in a primary sense. And you know what? Christianity has a way of living, a way of life. It's transformative. Christianity has commands, rules to follow and not to follow. It's a transformative gospel. But the way of Christianity isn't a list of rules. It's not something you accomplish on your own strength. The way is a person. You know, primarily at its very center, it's a person. Like, what do you do? The question is, what do you do with Jesus? Because you can't just say, well, I've investigated Christianity, you know, I've seen what it teaches and what it says as a world religion, but I reject it and I'm not a Christian, without making a decision related to who Jesus is and what he came to do. Because if Jesus is standing there risen, you know, Easter is the perfect time to contemplate this, because if Jesus is standing there risen from the dead, what do you do with that? How does that change the way we might respond to him? What does that mean about who he is, right? So over the course of our time in John, we've heard C.S. Lewis say this, you know, and I've said it, a number of others even on the preaching team, right? Like pointing to various claims that Jesus made in history and essentially saying, you know, I think it was Tim Keller that said, you know, you can't continue to embrace Jesus merely as a good teacher while also simultaneously ignoring his teaching. And yet that's what we often do, right? So to sum up Lewis's argument, and this is something that I think you can understand if you're here this morning as a child or as a student or as an adult, any phase of life, you can kind of wrap your mind around this, right? Because either Jesus was saying what he was saying and he was a lunatic, he was crazy, or he was a liar, or a combination of the two, right? Like a David Koresh kind of figure, manipulating people to join his cult out of a desire to have power, or a L. Ron Hubbard inventing a religion out of whole cloth in order to get power and wealth, something he said he would do before he invented it. And so either that's Jesus, he's a lunatic or a liar, or what he said is true, and he's Lord. But you can't claim he's not really God incarnate, but he's a good teacher. We heard philosophers make that argument. We heard pastors, philosophers, Bono, right? Remember? We heard Bono make this argument, saying the same thing. He said, Jesus does not allow you that, right? He doesn't. He doesn't allow you the convenience, Bono tells us, of dismissing him as Lord while also embracing him as a good teacher. Like, this is something everyone can kind of wrap their heads around. Why? Because he claimed to be God incarnate. He claimed to be God himself entering into human history to save humanity. This is what Jesus claimed. He claimed that he was the way, the truth, and the life, that no one would find life after death apart from him. Okay? He claimed that he would die, that he would rise from the grave, that he would come again as God to judge the nations. Like, listen. If someone came in to Gospel Life Church this morning, whether it was someone we'd never met and they came in off the streets, or whether it was like one of our own people, and they said, People of Gospel Life, I want you to know, I've got news for you, good news. You know that you should understand this about me. I saw Satan fall from heaven like lightning. I was there when that occurred. And I am that I am. I've been there from eternity past, and I'm the very God of very God. I'm God Himself. Would you respond? I mean, honestly, would you respond, well, I mean, I don't believe him, but what a gifted teacher. You know, I could just listen to him for hours. I was just hanging on his every word. And in the same way, John is drawing us out to respond to Jesus. He fundamentally asks the question over and over again, how will you respond to him, okay? The man who lived in history, who made in history these claims about his divinity and his death and his resurrection, the man who claimed to hold out saving life. The question about whether you will receive that life is inextricably bound up, you know, with the question, what do you do with him? Who's Jesus? And so in the text this morning, here's what we see. We see two responses, okay? Two responses to two different gospel events. We saw one gospel event out of three that we're looking at in close detail on Friday night, Good Friday, the death of Christ on the cross. And as we've seen mentioned many times, John is shepherding his readers to rightly respond to Jesus. So what he's doing here is now, you know, we see this event on Friday night, because of which we can say the Christian faith can be summed up as the faith of Christ crucified. It's the center of our faith. It's Jesus doing for us what we could never do for ourselves. It's him taking his punishment, taking our punishment, that we might be reconciled to God. And yet now we see two more gospel events, and John's focus in this really shifts to what our response must be. Okay, two responses to two events, beginning in verse 1. Now on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early, while it was still dark, and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. So she ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and said to them, "They've taken the Lord out of the tomb. We do not know where they've laid him." So Peter went out with the other disciple. They were going toward the tomb. Both of them were running together, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first, which is a hilarious detail. Verse 5, and stooping to look in, he saw the linen cloths lying there, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came, following him, and went into the tomb. He saw the linen clothes lying there, and the face cloth, which had been on Jesus' head, not lying with the linen cloths, but folded up in a place by itself. Then the other disciple, who'd reached the tomb first, also went in. He saw and believed, for as yet they did not understand the scripture, that he must rise from the dead. Then the disciples went back to their homes. So in verse 10, or in the first 10 verses, we first see two responses to the empty tomb. Okay, two responses to the empty tomb, unbelief and belief. And so here you see, like, the first gospel event that we look at in our text is an empty tomb. And we also see, bookending that, these responses of unbelief and belief. The empty tomb, discovered first by Mary. This is not Mary, the mother of Jesus. It's Mary Magdalene, a follower of Jesus, who was tending to the body. We don't know a lot about her, except that in Luke's account, she became a follower of Jesus after having seven demons cast out of her. She may have been a woman of some wealth and standing, and she was faithful in her devotion to Jesus. That's what the scriptures tell us about Mary Magdalene. She was faithful in her devotion. And on the one hand, we see evidence of that devotion by how early and how often, as we're going to see in a minute, she visits the tomb after Jesus' death to tend to the body, the spices, as was the custom. On the other hand, we see in her unbelief. And I'm going to say this a lot. I'm not being hard on Mary. We're going to see why by the end. But we do see unbelief in finding an empty tomb and not realizing the significance of it. And I'm going to say more about it because it's not just her. Okay. So she finds the empty tomb, which is considered, you should know, And in stressing this, I really am stressing what the gospel accounts stress. Like, the authors of the gospel accounts are very interested in proclaiming. They're very intentional in proclaiming this reality, that this is considered a historical fact. Like, this is history. This is something they witnessed. John's already said, I share these things as an eyewitness, right? Eyewitness testimony so that you might believe, right? So this is something that happened in history. And it's considered a historical fact by the majority of historians, the vast majority, actually. It's very hard on historical grounds to dispute the empty tomb. The reality that the women were the first to find the empty tomb is very unlikely to be made up if it's an invention in the first century to get people to believe it. The reality of the Romans and Jewish authorities having a very real interest in making sure that they knew where Jesus' body was, because we already know in this time of history, even in extra-biblical sources, how concerned they are about the idea of a messianic movement, right? So it's, of course, they, as the other gospel accounts testify, they want to know where it is. The reality that a named historical figure, Joseph of Arimathea, buries him in a known location, and that this gospel account of John is circulating in the first century, right? I mean, like, this is something that could be easily disproven. So all this has been considered, has led to even skeptical scholars and historians to see real evidence of the reality that the empty tomb is historical fact. It's really hard, actually, to make an argument from history otherwise. And so upon finding this empty tomb, she rushes back. So it's reality. She rushes back to tell Peter and John. And we can know more confidently now that the other disciple present in the text is John, gives this disciple the title of the one whom Jesus loved, the beloved disciple. I've talked in the past. This is how John identifies himself. And if you want to hear more about that, talk to me later and I can direct you to some places where we talked about that before. So Peter and John run to the tomb. And verse 4, you know, hilarious detail, used to make me laugh when I was a younger man. The other disciple outran Peter, reached the tomb first. It now humbles me as an older man, because that's likely why John outran Peter, you know. John is the younger one. I think it's, he reaches the tomb first. But it's also, you know, John doesn't necessarily depict himself as better, though he does mention that twice. He doesn't depict himself as somehow better than, because he talks about how he stops short. You know, he gets to the tomb, and he just kind of, and I get it, but he just kind of stoops inside. Right, but Peter, who if he was a younger man, I'm convinced would have outran John. He just blows right, excuse me, young guy, he just blows right past John, as is his character, right? We've been talking about that with Peter, very bold, and that's going to come again in chapter 21, and I keep saying that, but these are important details. Peter, the one who lunges out with dagger, Peter, the one who blows past John here at the tomb, you know, the one who's eager to say things out loud even when he's not necessarily thinking of the things that he's saying. So, okay, they get there. What they both see is this first gospel event of an empty tomb, grave clothes folded up. And in their discovery of the empty tomb, we really do see a contrast. And you know, there are so many contrasts in John 20, but I only have like 30 minutes. I wish we had more time to deal with, like, obviously we see in Easter Sunday a contrast between life and death, you know, at the center of it. But also there's a contrast between the old and the new. So how does the chapter begin? The way that all four gospel accounts record it. First day of the week. First day of the week. Both historically when it happened and a way of stressing the reality of something new. You know, the reality that this happens in a garden. This is a garden tomb. Mary confuses in a moment Jesus, the risen Jesus, with a gardener. So it's like the chains of sin and death are being broken in the garden. Sin came into the world in the garden. You know, like the first Adam, second Adam in Jesus Christ defeating death. Again, wish we had more time. All these contrasts, but I think the primary one John sets up in the narrative in a real direct way is unbelief and belief. Mary and seemingly Peter have at this point no hope in some form of a resurrection. John, perhaps because of the grave clothes being folded, you know, like it's very unique. This is not how a grave robber will go about his business, undressing and then folding things up nicely, right? Perhaps putting some things together with what Jesus said, he actually signals belief here. Now, to be fair, the text immediately then tells us, John tells us, even though he believed, none of them had any kind of belief according to their own scriptures, right? So it's a surprise. It's not like, oh yeah, that makes sense because of things that I was expecting. No. They don't realize what the scriptures actually teach, that Jesus must rise from the dead. Jesus is going to spell that out for them on his return, right? But the empty tomb on its own is in this text is powerful. It's a powerful gospel event. It's powerful enough to lead John to a sense of faith. And the question inherent in the text really is, how will you respond, right? So like that's each of these gospel events, each of these responses prompts in us an invitation to the reader. Like, how will you respond? Like, what are you going to do about this? Okay? Because, see, as we talked about before, in Judaism, and I keep saying, we're going to come back to it on Easter, so here you go. In Judaism, there wasn't a belief previous to the resurrection of Jesus that an individual would be resurrected in history and in time apart from this belief in a generalized resurrection at the end of time. And this is so important, I need to say it a different way so that you understand what I'm saying. There is, in Judaism, in Judaic thought, no view that one person would receive the resurrection while the rest of history just continued on unchecked. The one person, I'm not talking about Lazarus resurrection, where it's like raised to die again. I'm talking about glorified, resurrected body, the resurrection. Okay, so there's no belief that one guy gets this and the rest of history just continues on, you know, that death continues. And never, so important, never, 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 never is the word resurrection used. Ever in Judaism to describe something non-concrete, spiritual, you know. Never, never in the Bible, as a matter of fact, is this term resurrection used to describe something spiritual. It is always concrete. It's always physical. There are plenty of words available in the Judaic framework and in first century thought that would have meant something like apparition or something spiritually meaningful to me, right? Something like that. But never. It's not a spiritual term. It's concrete. It's physical. A physical bodily resurrection. Okay, so what this means is, listen, if we would have created a story, like, if first century Judaism would have created spun out a story from first century Judaism about a Messiah, and there are examples of this in Judaic history that we can point to that never got off the ground, of claimed Messiahs, and they look exactly how we would expect them to. They're going to conquer, you know, they're going to conquer the people oppressing them, they're going to save them in a nationalistic kind of way. Those stories look exactly the way first century Jewish people expected their Messiah to save them. But Jesus, no, look, listen, if we would have created a story, wouldn't have created this kind of story that we see here. Just wouldn't have. Don't have the vocabulary, don't have the background. And if we would not have seen a story created like this, it begs the question, where did it come from? Where, if it's not invented, if it's not something that would have been invented, where did it come from? It came from some event, as Daryl Bach has said many times, that moved the disciple to some effect to create a new theological category, like from which to view not only their own lives and ministries, not only Jesus' life and ministry, but their own lives and ministries and purposes, transformative of everything, as we're going to see in the early Christian church. Because listen, if there was a body in a tomb on Easter morning, no disciple is I promise you, it's just not possible. No disciple is leaving this place thinking, you know, that's okay. Jesus lives resurrected in my heart. That's all right. It's my own personal experience. Kill me if you want to, Romans. You know, like, persecute me unto death. I got this like, nice sentimental idea of Jesus living in my heart. No. Like, there's a reason Mary's in tears at the tomb. It's because she doesn't expect Jesus to be risen. There's a reason that in Luke's account, two disciples are headed out of town in disillusionment and fear, right? And they actually say, we thought he was the one to redeem Israel. We thought he was the Messiah, but now we know he's not. Why? He's dead. And there's no anticipation that there's any kind of resurrection. You see what I'm saying? It's just not something that anyone would have made up. And it's not something without which Christianity ever could have possibly came about. So Daryl Bach puts it this way, and it's super helpful. He says, I guarantee you, the New Testament scholar, works with a lot of the earliest manuscripts. He says, I guarantee you, if there had been a corpse in a tomb or a body that could have been produced, the persecutor Saul would have never become the Apostle Paul, right? Like, I mean, in the first century, Christians are not going to explode in the first century. I mean, this is just an easily, no, his body is there. The tomb isn't empty. This whole idea of a resurrected Jesus, we can prove it false right away. We can put his body on display, which is exactly what the Romans would have done. So it changed the entire course of history. The question is, and the question that the text invites us to, what do you do with it? There's an invitation here to reconsider Jesus. Do you think this claim that Jesus is God, that he's resurrected, could really have given rise to the explosion of the early church, the widespread belief that he was physically risen, if there was a body in the tomb? So we have this first gospel event, empty tomb. Two contrasted responses, unbelief and belief. But now we see the second one, verses 11 through 18. But Mary stood weeping outside the tomb. And as she wept, she stooped to look into the tomb. And she saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had lain, one at the head and one at the feet. They said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "They've taken my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." So here we see it. A second gospel event begin to emerge in the text. It's still an empty tomb now, but through 18 we see resurrection. Two responses to the resurrection. And again, it's the same two responses. John's setting up the same contrast. It's unbelief and belief. Because again, we see Mary's devotion, her tenderness towards Jesus. You know, her weeping outside the tomb is a signal of her tenderness and love, for sure. And she, like John, stoops to look inside. There's no dead body, but she does see two angels, and they grab her attention, but not because she thinks they're angelic. Not because she believes them to be angels. It's because she believes they might be able to help her find Jesus' body, not Jesus risen. So again, listen, it's just very normal, okay? So we see here this failure to recognize those that God sent to the tomb, the message they were proclaiming to her. So the angels regularly appear as human visitors throughout the Old Testament. Mary certainly would have been familiar enough with those stories. They speak to her asking, "Woman, why are you weeping?" And, you know, it's more than a question. They know the reason behind this empty tomb, the reason behind this first response should lead to the opposite response, you know? It should lead to joy. Or, if there are tears, it should be tears of joy. And they know it's not. So this question is something of a mild rebuke, but more than that, an invitation, a drawing out, an invitation to reconsider. And the text gives us, as readers, an invitation to reconsider. Jesus really did live. He did claim what John writes here. He did die on a cross. He was buried in a known location. The tomb was found empty. The text, like the angels, wants the reader to reconsider their doubts. Because by now, she shouldn't have been crying. Her reaction here, while clearly demonstrating love and devotion, also demonstrates she's not moving past her initial understanding of who Jesus was. You know, she's kind of stuck there. And you can see that she's stuck because she gives the same exact response that she gave in verse 2. "They've taken away my Lord. I don't know where they've laid him." So now we have our first response to this second event of resurrection, which is unbelief. And again, we see this in the disciples' response too, with those words in verse 9 that we already looked at together. But now we see the second gospel event. Verse 14, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, okay? Look at verse 14. She sees Jesus standing there. What do you notice? She doesn't recognize him. Now, it's possible that she's blinded by her tears. You know, we've all been there when you've been crying and you look up and you can't, like, see, right? There's just a little bit of blurriness. It's possible. It's possible that she's in so much shock and grief that she's just not noticing detail. Probably there is a sense of a little bit of both. But I think the best explanation is that she doesn't recognize him to be Jesus because she's not expecting to see Jesus. Jesus has died. You know, and again, I'm not getting after Mary. Like, this is this is very normal. Like, even if there is a resemblance of some kind, her response just reinforces this belief the resurrection didn't occur. It's not some crazy thing. If you had just been to a funeral for a person on a Friday, you would not expect to see them on a Sunday. And if you saw someone who looked like them, it might move you again to sadness and grief, right? So her only hope as she sees it is finding this dead body so that he might be brought back and buried properly. She's not hoping to find him alive. She's not. And Jesus so graciously responds, you know, woman, why are you weeping? And then he asks the follow-up, which is like the very question that I've been getting at. Like, what do you do with Jesus? Whom are you seeking? That's an interesting question. Whom are you seeking? Are you seeking, what kind of Messiah are you seeking? What kind of Savior are you seeking? Whom are you seeking? Like, standing right in front of her. And just like the angels, he's not trying to collect information. He knows the answer to these questions, obviously. But he wants her to think more deeply about it. He's extending an invitation. It's more than a question. It's an invitation to reflect on the kind of Messiah she was expecting. As one commentator says, it's an invitation for Mary to widen her horizons, recognize that her view of him was far too small. And so it's an invitation to the reader to widen our horizons, and see that so often, even as believers, our view of Jesus is far too small. And it's far too predicated based on circumstances around us and the culture in which we live, rather than something that Jesus has done for us that we could never do for ourselves. Who he is, where he is now, how he reigns now. He's in control now. Okay, so it's an invitation to the reader to do the same. This Jesus lived in history, claimed to be God, died upon a cross, buried in a known location. His tomb was found empty, and he was seen alive again. We'll get to that in a minute, but would you take, these are things that all historians believe. We have a set of facts. Would you take in these historical realities and reconsider Jesus? If he's standing before you, like, if Jesus is standing before you risen, how does that change how you might see him? Would you reconsider your view of him? Mary supposes him to be the gardener. Yet Jesus is gracious with her small view of him. Jesus said to her, Mary, it's a personal invitation. This isn't just an invitation. It's not just an invitation for her to reconsider. It's a personal invitation. And Jesus extends the same personal invitation to you this morning, Jeremy, you know, to us, to the reader, Mary. And she turns and says, teacher, you know. Here, what happens? Her unbelief is turned to belief. How? By the grace of Christ alone, the sheer grace of God in revealing himself to her, the same way that ours is. Any belief that we have is because of the grace of the Lord in revealing himself to us and showing us the truth by way of his Spirit, his word revealed to us. Unbelief is turned to belief by Jesus' self-revelation. She falls to his feet. She grasps him, and he says, essentially, listen, I'm not leaving yet. I haven't ascended to the Father yet. Don't worry. You don't need to cling to me. I'm going to be with you. I'm going to teach you before I leave. I have good news that because of my death at the cross, you have now, you know, the curtain was torn, right? You have access to the Father. You have access to the Father. The Father is your Father. My Father is now your Father. You know, the one who you rebelled against, the created world order in act of rebellion, against his creator, that creator is now your father. God is now your God. So this isn't a time for staying and clinging. What's it a time for? Going and telling. He says, go and tell. You know, and we've said before, if we had a series title for all of John's account, it would be go and tell, because we see these words repeatedly through John's account. If you remember early on, where did we hear it? Very, very quickly. In the first few chapters, Jesus says it to his disciples, go and tell, you know. And the disciples say it to one another, go and tell. Why? Because they had this encounter with the living God, and they couldn't help but go and tell, go and tell. And now he tells Mary, go and tell, and she does. And there would be, because of these gospel events, much going and telling in the history of the church, so I'm going to end it this way. Renowned historian N.T. Wright says this. He says, what can historians in the 21st century say about Easter on the basis of the historical arguments, on the basis of the testimony that the Gospels give us? And again, I talk about this every year, but it's so important. And people, you know, like, there are those of us who want to kind of get away from the historical argument a bit, but it's like, it's very important. It's very important to the authors of the Gospel, but it's also very important to your faith. Because if this didn't happen in history, the Apostle Paul says, you're still in your sins. We might as well not be here, right? So, what can we say about it? Far and away, the best explanation is that two things happened. First, Jesus' tomb was found empty. And again, this is not something that the vast majority of historians dispute. Second, again, something that the vast majority of historians don't dispute, several people, including some who had not previously been followers of Jesus, claimed to see him alive in a way for which the readily available language of ghosts, spirits, and the like were inappropriate. Like, they had language at their disposal that they could have used to describe this if it wasn't resurrection. But that's not what they said. So, continuing. Oh, I will go to this text here. Several people, including some who had not previously been followers of Jesus before the resurrection, claimed to see him alive in a way for which the readily available language of ghosts, spirits, and the like were inappropriate, and for which their previous beliefs about life after death and resurrection in particular had not prepared them. Okay, listen to this now. Can you check the next slide? See if I put it on the wrong side? Nope. Well, nope. Okay, that's from last week. All right. Let's just keep going. All right. Take away. Listen to this. Listen. Don't get distracted. Take away either of these historical conclusions. Empty tomb, resurrection appearances. Take away either of these historical conclusions, and the belief of the early church becomes itself inexplicable. Let me say that again. Take away either of these historical conclusions, and the belief of the early church itself becomes inexplicable, like it wouldn't have gotten off the ground. How would we explain it otherwise? He says the further question is, why was the tomb empty? And what account can be given of the sightings of the apparently risen Jesus? The best historical explanation is the tomb was indeed empty. And Jesus was indeed seen alive because he was truly raised from the dead. Okay, listen. I had a slide that said, how will you respond to Jesus? So imagine it. How will you respond to Jesus? Here Jesus stands, risen from the dead. How will you respond to him? And if Jesus is standing there, risen from the dead, what do you do with that? Because he has good news. Because of his death on a cross, his Father is now your Father. You have full access to God. Your sins have been forgiven if you respond by faith. Belief that he's done for you what you could never do for yourself, and we can know that that's true. Like, we can know that he bore the penalty of our sin on Good Friday because on Easter Sunday, he rose from the dead. If he didn't do that, fair enough. You can say, I don't believe it, but he did it. How do you respond to it, right? So it's like, we can know that it's true. He bore the weight of punishment. He bore the weight of God's wrath fully and completely. We know that it's true by the power of his resurrection, so we can have hope. What can we have hope in? That death is defeated. We can have hope that death is defeated. We can see in his resurrection a glimpse of our future reality for those who die in Jesus Christ. And so we declare with the people of God this morning, around the world, a liturgy that churches around the world proclaimed. I'm going to say, he's risen, and I'd like you to respond with, he's risen indeed. And we'll do this 3 times this morning, and then we'll sing, and we'll worship together. He is risen.
He is risen.
He is risen.
He is risen.
He is risen.